Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Tuesday, April 9th, 2024. Arizona Supreme Court rules that an 1864 law banning abortion except to save a mother's life and punishable by jail time is still in effect. House Speaker Mike Johnson delays sending impeachment articles against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to the Senate until Monday. Originally, it was going to be tomorrow. It was at the request of Senate Republicans, who say having a full week will increase the chances of a full impeachment trial, since Senate Democrats may try to vote immediately to dismiss the charges. The House accuses Secretary Mayorkas of not upholding U.S. immigration laws. Senator Ben Cardin, Democrat of Maryland, says he'll introduce a bill to ensure the federal government pays 100% of the cost to replace the collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore. He and the Maryland congressional delegation met with Governor Wes Moore and Biden administration officials today on Capitol Hill. President Joe Biden talks about supporting what he calls the care economy, including child care, long-term care, and paid family leave. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan takes reporters' questions about developments in the war between Israel and Hamas. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin testifies in favor of more U.S. aid to Ukraine as the U.S. House returns from recess. And there is still uncertainty about how Speaker Johnson will proceed with the president's supplemental request for national security. And the Japanese Prime Minister Kishida Fumio begins his official visit to the U.S. with a stop at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in Washington. Story from CNN. In a historic decision Tuesday, the Arizona Supreme Court ruled the state must adhere to a 123-year-old law barring all abortions except in cases when it is necessary to save a pregnant person's life. The law, which can be traced to as early as 1864 and was codified in 1901, also carried a prison sentence of 2 to 5 years for abortion providers. There is a 14-day stay on the law. Arizona's near-total abortion ban will be one of the strictest in the nation, placing it alongside Texas, Alabama, and Mississippi, where there are abortion bans in place with almost no exceptions. That reporting from CNN. U.S. Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat from Arizona, reacted at a news conference in Washington.
I want to say a few words about the disastrous decision by the Arizona Supreme Court today to reinstate a total ban on abortion. From a law that was passed in 1864, before Arizona was a state, actually 48 years before Arizona became a state. Senator Stabenow mentioned one out of three women live in a state that have an extreme abortion ban. Well, about 30 minutes ago, that number went up. This is going to criminalize doctors for doing their jobs, and it's going to have a devastating effect on the health and freedom of women in Arizona. It's going to put lives at risk. Now, this law may have been written 160 years ago, but it's only being reinstated now because of politicians who worked to overturn Roe v. Wade. In fact, in the Supreme Court ruling today, it mentioned the Dobbs decision 22 times. This is devastating for women in Arizona. I've got a daughter and granddaughter in Arizona. This is not who we are as Arizonans. And I refuse to allow Arizona to become a state where doctors are going to be afraid to practice, to just do their jobs. Women deserve the right to make these decisions on their own, not politicians in Washington making them for them. So I'm going to continue to work to fix this. But I've got to, you know, stress that this is a really sad day for the state of Arizona.
Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat from Arizona, at a news conference today in Washington, D.C. The other U.S. Senate seat from Arizona, currently held by independent Kyrsten Sinema, will be up for grabs, an open seat this November. And TheHill.com reports that both Arizona Senate candidates came out against the state Supreme Court's decision Tuesday that upholds one of the strictest abortion bans in the country. Congressman Ruben Gallego, Democrat, and Republican candidate Carrie Lake each said the ruling should be overturned. Lake said in a statement, "I understand the fear and anxiety of pregnancy and the joy of motherhood. I wholeheartedly agree with President Trump. This is a very personal issue that should be determined by each individual state and her people. I oppose today's ruling, and I am calling on Governor Katie Hobbs and the state legislature to come up with an immediate common sense solution that Arizonans can support." And Gallego, meanwhile, doubled down on his stance in favor of abortion rights. "Today's ruling is devastating for Arizona women and their families," he said. "This is not what Arizonans want." Gallego also shared Lake's previous comments on the 1864 bill hours after the ruling, using them as an attack on her record. He wrote on X, "I won't let Carrie Lake distort the record. She called the law a great law, even though it will ban nearly all abortions, including in cases of rape and incest." That was from thehill.com. The U.S. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, also took a reporter's question at this at a separate news conference on Capitol Hill.
Arizona Supreme Court just moved forward with a near total ban on abortion. Given your role and the Senate Republicans' role in confirming three justices overturned Roe, are you concerned about voter backlash on this issue?
Well, you're asking me about an Arizona Supreme Court decision. I haven't taken a look at it yet, but I'm certain, as you are, that this whole issue will continue to unfold during the course of the campaign.
Leader McConnell.
The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. The Arizona Mirror writes that Justice John R. Lopez IV, writing for the court in a 4-2 split decision, said that a 2022 law allowing abortions up to 15 weeks of gestation depended on the existence of a federal constitutional right to abortion. And since the U.S. Supreme Court eliminated that right in the Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization ruling 2 years ago, that law can't overrule one first passed in 1864 when Arizona was a territory. Lopez wrote, "In light of this opinion, physicians are now on notice that all abortions except those necessary to save a woman's life are illegal." This is Washington Today. Another story from CNN. The U.S. House will send impeachment articles against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to the Senate next week, a delay that comes as Senate Republicans seek more time to develop a strategy to deal with the effort. Speaker Mike Johnson, through a spokesperson, Taylor Hussley, told CNN in a statement, "To ensure the Senate has adequate time to perform its constitutional duty, the House will transmit the articles of impeachment to the Senate next week. There is no reason whatsoever for the Senate to abdicate its responsibility to hold an impeachment trial." House Republican leaders had initially planned to transmit the articles to the Senate on Wednesday, but some Senate Republicans have been urging Speaker Johnson to delay the transfer as they try to build more support for blocking an expected motion from Democrats to dismiss the trial. That was from CNN. Some of those Senate Republicans held a news conference today, including Ron Johnson of Wisconsin.
Democrats, President Biden, want an open border. They caused this problem. We didn't need a law passed to have President Biden have the authority to close the border. President Trump, using existing law, closed the border. President Biden, using that exact same authority, opened it up. So you can see the explosion from the end of the Trump administration, where virtually we had the border closed, and then the explosion and the widening gap as President Biden allowed Title 42 to expire. But even without that, even using Title 42, they welcomed, they incentivized families, unaccompanied children, and subjected them to the depredations. Their open border policy facilitates the multi-billion-dollar business model of some of the most evil people on the planet. The human traffickers, the sex traffickers, the drug traffickers, poisoning our cities. That's what Biden and the Democrats, and this is important to note too, it's not just President Biden. This is Democrat policies. That's what must be defeated. But Senator Schumer wants to nip this impeachment trial in the bud because he doesn't want the House managers to make the case, to explore exactly what happened, how their actions, how their policies are causing this invasion. They don't want to be held accountable. That's why a trial is imperative in the United States Senate, and why I so appreciate what Speaker Johnson apparently just announced, that he's going to delay delivery of these things so that Senator Schumer doesn't have Thursday at 1 o'clock to just snuff this thing out.
Senator Ron Johnson, Republican from Wisconsin, at a news conference with other Senate Republicans, many of them referring to Thursday as the getaway day, and there would be pressure for the Senate to wrap up its business so that senators could head to wherever they're going for the weekend. The Senate Democrats have a 51-49 majority of seats over the Republicans currently, so defeating the procedural motions that may be offered by Republicans and dismissing the charges against Secretary Mayorkas will require almost all the Democrats to stick together. Even if there is a trial, though, it is not likely that there would be a two-thirds majority vote needed to convict Secretary Mayorkas. Earlier in the day, before it was clear that House Speaker Johnson was going to delay the sending over of the impeachment articles, the Senate Majority Leader, Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, at a news conference, asked about his plans.
Your colleagues say you're going to offer a motion to dismiss the impeachment charges on Thursday. Are you at all concerned that if some Democrats in tough races vote for that, you come back to the campaign trail?
Look, we're going to try and resolve this issue as quickly as possible. Impeachment should never be used to settle policy disagreements.
Leadership.
Yes. Does that mean that this is going to, there might be a debate about some sort of a framework first, at least hear from the managers? What do you think is
As I said, we're going to try to resolve this as quickly as possible. As I've said in the past, it's absurd, and there are no charges in the House complaint that rise to the level of impeachment.
Senator,
yes.
Does that mean dismissing it or tabling it?
As I said,
do you have the vote?
We're going to move forward and resolve this as quickly as possible. Once again, impeachment should never be used to settle policy disagreements.
The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, at a news conference today. This was before it was clear that House Speaker Mike Johnson would be delaying sending the impeachment articles to the Senate until next week. Originally, it was thought it would happen tomorrow, and so that trial or the motions to dismiss could happen on Thursday. Senator Schumer reacting to the delay, saying we're ready to go whenever they are. We're sticking with our plan. We're going to move this as expeditiously as possible. The Republican-led House voted to impeach Secretary Mayorkas in February by a vote of 214-13, making him the second cabinet secretary in American history to be impeached. The first was almost 150 years ago. House Republicans arguing that the secretary violated the Constitution by deliberately refusing to enforce border security laws. From WJLA-TV in Washington, the Maryland delegation plans to introduce a bill that would ensure a full federal fund to rebuild Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge. Senator Ben Cardin announced Tuesday. This comes after President Joe Biden pledged last week that the federal government will provide 100% of the funds for the reconstruction of the Key Bridge following its collapse. It was the early morning of March 26th. A cargo ship leaving the Port of Baltimore struck the bridge, causing it to collapse and sending six construction workers into the water. Some were never seen again. That from WJLA-TV. Senator Cardin held a news conference on Capitol Hill today, along with Senator Chris Van Hollen, the other senator from Maryland, U.S. House members from Maryland, the Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, and Governor Wes Moore, and others.
President Biden has made it clear and has delivered on the commitment that the personnel and resources of the federal government will be there, have been there from day one, to get the job done as quickly as possible, and we are extremely thankful. We got an update in regards to the opening of the channel. Incredible work had been done. These divers that go down there, it's really dangerous work. We now have two channel, alternative channels that are open. We have a third channel that will be opened this month that will deal with the majority of traffic into the Port of Baltimore. And by the end of May, we hope to have the entire channel reopened. That's incredible work by very talented people. We also are working right now on the replacement of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. So the question was asked, what do you need from Congress in order to make this happen the way that we want to make sure it's happened without any delay? And we intend to introduce legislation very soon, coordinated through our delegation, that will clarify that in regards to the federal participation by the state, that this will be 100% federal funds in regards to the costs related to the destruction and replacement of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. That legislation is necessary because of a 90-10 in the original language. This is not unprecedented. The 100% was used in regards to the Minnesota bridge replacement. And this is a commitment that is normal for this type of a catastrophic loss of a major infrastructure in our country. We will also make it clear, as it is under current law, that in regards to any third-party recoveries from liable entities or insurance will go to relieve the federal taxpayers of the burdens that have been sustained as a result of the loss of the bridge. But as it was pointed out at this meeting, that process will not delay the immediate moving forward with the replacement of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. We will not delay until liability is established, but once liability is established and funds are received, it will go towards the taxpayers.
Senator Ben Cardin, Democrat from Maryland, at today's news conference that included some Biden administration officials, Governor of Maryland Wes Moore, and other members of the Maryland congressional delegation. This happened in the U.S. Capitol building. A story from the Washington Post: funding could face obstacles from some congressional Republicans, even though such aid has been approved on a bipartisan basis in the past. The Conservative Freedom Caucus, for example, conditioned federal aid on several factors, including cutting the federal budget elsewhere, limiting how the money could be spent, and tying it to the Biden administration's policies on liquefied natural gas export terminals. That was from the Washington Post. At today's news conference, Congressman Andy Harris, Republican from Maryland, the only Republican in the Maryland congressional delegation, said he supports the full funding from the federal government.
First and foremost, be certain to keep in your prayers the six families who were affected most deeply by this event. Now, beyond that, tragedy knows no partisanship. This wasn't a Republican tragedy, it wasn't a Democrat tragedy, and the solution won't be a partisan solution, it'll be a bipartisan solution. I'm committed to working because we know that there will be legislation that's necessary in order to deal with this, in order to make sure that Maryland doesn't have to bear a cost share, to make sure that this bridge is built back better than the bridge that was there already. And I'm committed to make sure that we navigate this through a bipartisan process, both houses, get it to the president's desk so that we can bring relief again to the city of Baltimore, the state of Maryland, and get that bridge rebuilt. Thank you.
Congressman Andy Harris, Republican from Maryland, at today's news conference with other members of the Maryland congressional delegation and administration officials and the governor on Capitol Hill. Associated Press writes that more than 50 salvage divers and 12 cranes are on site to help cut out sections of the bridge and remove them from the key waterway. Crews began removing containers from the deck over the weekend, and they're making progress toward removing sections of the bridge that lie across the ship's bow so it can eventually move, according to the Key Bridge Response Unified Command. President Joe Biden spoke today about what he calls the care economy at a rally with care workers at Union Station in Washington, D.C. The Hill writes the president spoke at an event hosted by Care Can't Wait Action, a coalition of groups focused on expanding access to child care, paid family and medical leave, and home-based services. Representatives from the AFL-CIO, SEIU, AARP, and National Domestic Workers Alliance attended, as did members of Congress Debbie Dingell and Rosa DeLauro. Debbie Dingell, Democrat of Michigan, Rosa DeLauro, Democrat from Connecticut. Here's President Biden.
My budget for next year makes key commitments to children, seniors, and people with disabilities, and to caregivers who look after their loved ones. First, for working families with small children, we're going to guarantee affordable quality child care. Most families, from our plan, most families will pay less than $10 a day per child, saving millions of folks as much as $7,000 a year. That's a lot of breathing room for young families who need it badly. We'll also restore the expanded child care tax credit, lifting millions of children out of poverty. And by the way, this helps the economy. It doesn't hurt you. It helps the economy. You know, our Republican friends let that expire. Well, we got to expire a couple of them politically in order to get this passed. Together, we're going to bring it back. Second, Seniors and people with disabilities, we're going to expand Medicaid home care services and reduce that 700,000-person backlog. That'll mean more folks can live and work in their own communities with dignity and independence. More home care workers will start getting a better pay and benefits and dignity they deserve. By the way, if anybody's listening besides all of us, we agree on this. This is really, we're deadly earnest. This is not a joke. It matters. Third, for everyone caring for a loved one, my budget would finally create a national paid family and medical leave program. Finally. Up to 12 weeks to care for a newborn, a sick loved one, or yourself without losing your income. Look, it's past time America caught up with the rest of the world on paid leave. And folks, all this helps families and it grows the economy. It grows the economy. And we can afford to do it. To put it another, we can't afford not to do it. Look, I'm a capitalist, but I want to make sure that, you know, if you make $1 million, great. Just start paying your fair share in taxes.
President Joe Biden at a rally with workers that care for others professionally, held at Union Station in Washington, D.C. An article from Gray News has this: care work, which makes all other work possible, is also the fastest growing sector of work in the world, projected to add 150 million jobs by 2030, according to the Wilson Center. Because of the inequalities in the distribution of care work, women globally lost more than 64 million jobs because of the COVID-19 pandemic, resulting in more than $800 billion in lost income in 1 year, the Wilson Center said. That was from an article by Gray News. From NBC News, an Idaho teenager was arrested and accused of planning to kill churchgoers during church services across his hometown in the name of the Islamic State group, authorities have said. Alexander Scott Mercurio, 18 years old, from Coeur d'Alene, was arrested early Saturday as part of the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force investigation, a day before prosecutors say he planned to carry out the attack. He's accused of attempting to provide material support and resources to ISIS, according to a federal criminal complaint filed in Idaho on Monday. The FBI said he was actively planning to attack churches Sunday in Coeur d'Alene, a town 30 miles east of Spokane, using weapons, including knives, firearms, and fire, a statement said. The attack was timed to coincide with the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, investigators said. That was from NBC News. The FBI director, Christopher Wray, spoke today at an American Bar Association luncheon dealing with national security. He did talk about terrorism. He said it's still the number one concern.
I've been very public in saying that at a time when the terrorism threat was already elevated, the ongoing war in the Middle East has raised the threat of an attack against Americans inside the United States to a whole nother level. One big reason for that is the steady drumbeat of calls for attacks that we've seen since October 7th from a veritable rogues gallery of foreign terrorist organizations, groups ranging from Hezbollah to Al-Qaeda to ISIS. Against America and our allies. Hezbollah has publicly expressed its support and praise for Hamas and threatened to attack U.S. interests in the region. Al-Qaeda issued its most specific call to attack the United States in the past 5 years. AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, called on jihadists to attack Americans and Jewish people everywhere. And foreign terrorists, including ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and their adherents, have renewed calls for attacks against Jewish communities here in the United States and across the West in statements and in propaganda. Now, as this group probably knows, these are groups that haven't always seen eye to eye, and that's probably an understatement, now united in their calls for attacks on us. Given those calls for action, we cannot and do not discount the possibility that foreign terrorists may exploit the conflict to carry out an attack. And while we continue to be concerned about individuals or small groups drawing some kind of twisted inspiration from the events in the Middle East to carry out attacks here at home, the foreign terrorist threat and the potential for a coordinated attack here in the homeland, like the ISIS-K attack we saw at the Russia concert hall just a couple weeks ago, is now increasingly concerning. October 7th and the conflict that's followed are going to feed a pipeline of radicalization and mobilization for years to come.
FBI Director Christopher Wray at a luncheon in Washington held by the American Bar Association's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. He also spoke about threats from state actors, including China and Russia, and his main focus was support of reauthorizing Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, the so-called warrantless wiretap authority against non-U.S. citizens in other countries, as the House is scheduled to vote on that this week. Washington Today continues in a moment.
Hi there. I'm Jonathan from C-SPAN, along with my colleague, Ben. Since C-SPAN's founding 45 years ago, the media world has changed. Remember when there were just a few TV channels? Now we've got streaming, social media, apps, and more.
Through all of this, C-SPAN has stayed true to its mission of giving you unfiltered access to government wherever you get your news. As we navigate this challenging media environment with fewer people subscribing to traditional cable packages, our funding has been impacted.
That's why we're asking for your help to keep going strong for another 45 years. Please donate today at cspan.org/donate. Your contribution, large or small, helps ensure at least another 45 years of witnessing democracy in action.
Keep C-SPAN thriving in today's ever-changing media landscape. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your gift today. Thank you.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you find your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. Vice President Kamala Harris, writes CBS News, is meeting on Tuesday with families of hostages believed to be held by Hamas since the attack on Israel 6 months ago on October 7th. Five Americans remain unaccounted for and are believed to have been taken hostage by Hamas during the attacks. At the White House, the National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan joined the press conference getting questions about developments in the war.
Jake, could you update us where things stand on the latest hostage negotiations? Is any real progress being made? I think Hamas rejected the latest proposal. Are both sides making the kind of concessions that are going to be necessary?
As you know, Bill Burns was in Cairo on Sunday. There was a marathon session that went late into the night among the United States, Israel, Qatar, and Egypt. Qatar and Egypt, of course, were communicating with Hamas through this process. And we have seen Israel take some steps forward in terms of what they're putting on the table. And of course, we've seen the public statements from Hamas that have been, shall we say, less than encouraging. But I spoke with the Prime Minister of Qatar, Sheikh Mohammed, this morning. He does not yet have an answer from Hamas. I pressed him to try to secure an answer from them as soon as possible. And when we have more to report on that front, we will report it to you. Yeah.
Two things. Prime Minister Netanyahu says he has a date for the Rafah operation. Will the administration take any action or restrict military support for Israel if Netanyahu moves forward on Rafah?
If he has a date, he hasn't shared it with us. So I've seen his public comments, but I have nothing more on that front. I'm not going to comment on hypotheticals, but I will state here what I stated the last time I stood at this podium, which is that the United States does not believe that a massive ground invasion of Rafah, where 1.3 or more million people are sheltering, having been pushed out of other parts of Gaza that are now destroyed, into the area where humanitarian assistance comes in. This is not the best way forward. There are better ways to go after Hamas and Rafah. We presented those ways to our Israeli counterparts in a session we held last week. There have been ongoing technical talks between our teams since then, and I anticipate we'll have another opportunity at senior levels to engage them in Rafah, and that conversation will stay ongoing. And then we will make determinations about how we proceed based on how those conversations unfold. Yeah.
To follow up on that, Jake, if the U.S. is not even being looped in on the date for when this military operation is set to take place, why do you think the U.S. has any influence in those upcoming meetings to change Israel's strategy?
First of all, when you talk about looped in, the Prime Minister makes public statements. He also talks to us in private about aspects of operations, about their thinking with respect to Rafah in some considerable detail. I sat in a situation room not long ago in a secure video conference that went on for hours going into specifics on this. So I can't speak to every public comment he makes. What I can tell you is that we have open channels of communication with the Israelis on these issues. They understand our position. And we have been very clear about our deep and abiding concerns about a Rafah operation and our belief that there are better ways to deal with the strategic threat Hamas poses than some of the ideas that have been put forward, and our further belief that any kind of plan to protect civilians in a serious way in Rafah, that's something we have yet to see be presented to us, and so our concerns continue. And now we will have to wait and see what happens, and the United States will respond accordingly.
The White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan in the White House briefing room. Another reporter asked him about his postponed trip to the Middle East because of an injury.
Jake, you were scheduled to travel to Saudi Arabia before you were recently injured. First, how are you doing? And second, is there a rescheduling of that meeting with the Crown Prince back on the books?
Cracking your rib is very painful. Maybe not as painful as answering your questions, but I kind of rushed the timing on that joke, which I prepared for. So, it hurts a lot. Some of you may have cracked your ribs at some point. There's not a lot you can do about it other than just rest. And yes, I intend to go to Saudi Arabia.
What happened? Nothing scheduled yet.
What happened, Jake? You got to tell us.
Questions to the White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan today. From Associated Press, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Joint Chiefs Chairman General C.Q. Brown Jr. testified on Capitol Hill on Tuesday about the Pentagon's $850 billion budget for 2025, as questions remained as to whether lawmakers will support current spending needs for Israel or Ukraine. The Senate hearing was the first time lawmakers on both sides were able to question the Pentagon's top civilian and military leadership on the administration's Israel strategy following Tel Aviv's deadly strike on World Central Kitchen humanitarian aid workers in Gaza. It also follows continued desperate pleas by Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky that if the U.S. does not help soon, Kyiv will lose the war to Ukraine. That was from Associated Press. Here's a few minutes of the three-hour hearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Senator Eric Schmidt, Republican from Missouri, questioning Secretary Austin about aid to Ukraine.
So what does victory look like for Ukraine? Yeah. How do you define victory?
You may have heard me say this earlier, Senator, but we've said from the very beginning that what we want to see is a Ukraine that's a democratic country that has that is independent and has the ability to protect its sovereign territory, to defend its sovereign territory, and to deter aggression.
Does that mean Crimea is part of Ukraine?
Crimea is a part of Ukraine.
Well, okay, right. But in order for the war to be over, does Ukraine have to control Crimea?
In terms of how things transition going forward, I would not want to predict what President Zelensky will decide.
I think part of the problem, with all due respect, is that this administration has not articulated what an exit strategy is. To me, this is a blank check for a war that, without any clearly defined goals, will be endless. And that is, so the skepticism among, I didn't vote for the supplemental because I don't think that we don't have adequate controls on how the money is being spent. Victory hasn't been defined. So for America's interest, I understand America's interest, we're continuing to head down this road, and now we're getting a budget request that isn't reflective of the administration's, for however long it takes, statement. So that's part of the objection. I guess one of the issues, too, is, and I want to make sure I'm clear, is it the administration's position that Ukraine should be admitted into NATO?
It's NATO's position overall that...
The United States of America. What is the administration's position on Ukraine's admission to NATO?
I think you've heard the president say that, and of course, NATO has an open door policy. So all of the countries have worked towards...
I'm really not trying to put you in a weird spot. I just heard Secretary Blinken say, or maybe it was a mistranslation, so I'm just looking for clarity. if it's the position of the United States of America that Ukraine should be admitted into NATO?
It was that question as to whether or not they should be admitted right now or in the future?
Either or.
Well, right now they're in a war, Senator.
So that would be a disastrous result because we would go to war.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
But let's say the war ends tomorrow.
That's what all.
Or September 30th, based on this budget, is ends September 30th. Is it the position of this administration that Ukraine should be admitted into NATO?
It's unlikely that the war will end on September 30th. But again, it's the goal of the alliance to bring Ukraine into the alliance at some point in the future.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin questioned by Senator Eric Schmidt, Republican from Missouri, at the Armed Services Committee hearing today, looking at President Biden's fiscal year 2025 budget request for the Defense Department. Story from the New York Post, far-right Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, warned her congressional colleagues Tuesday she would move to oust House Speaker Mike Johnson should Congress pass military aid for Ukraine, but hold off on approving conservative priorities like U.S. border enforcement. I will not tolerate our elected Republican Speaker Mike Johnson serving the Democrats and the Biden administration and helping them achieve their policies that are destroying our country, Green wrote in a scathing Dear Colleague letter, a copy of which was obtained by the Post, explaining her threat to remove Johnson over an additional $60 billion in Ukraine funding. She continued, this has been a complete and total surrender to, if not complete and total lockstep with, the Democrats' agenda that has angered our Republican base so much and given them very little reason to vote for a Republican House majority. That was from the New York Post. Congresswoman Green was interviewed by former Donald Trump White House advisor Steve Bannon for his podcast on Monday.
Mike Johnson's actually putting an element here that would end the dollar as a prime reserve currency. There's actually going to be a component when he finally releases this bill. What I'm hearing will be about taking the frozen assets of the Russian people, stealing them, seizing them, converting them into dollars and getting them to the Ukrainians. Since Johnson's bound and determined to force what the MAGA base and the Republican Party base does not want and also force it on FISA, you've put in a motion to vacate. Now, he's saying he's been talking to you. What have your conversations with Speaker Johnson been like as you guys now head back to Washington?
Well, I texted him on Friday and I told him I would not be speaking to him on Friday, that I had to talk to my district and my constituents first at the town hall tonight. That's going to be great. I hope everyone watches it. I hope lots of people come to it. But there's no reason for me to talk to him. I don't work for Mike Johnson. I work for Georgia 14, and that's the people that I need to talk to. But going forward, I mean, think this through, Steve. Let's really analyze and talk about this. He's talking about, confiscating assets from the Russian people, just like you said. Well, that's pretty much illegal. They're having a lot of problems with that. And Europe does not want to do it. And that's where most of those assets are. But let's talk about what this really is, Steve. This is a war on Christianity. The Ukrainian government is attacking Christians. The Ukrainian government is executing priests. Russia is not doing that. They're not attacking Christianity. As a matter of fact, they seem to be protecting it. So that's something else that's clear and obvious to many people that are looking closely at what's going on. I'm not praising Vladimir Putin. I'm not praising Russia in any way. I'm just pointing out something clear and obvious to many people.
Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, on the Steve Bannon podcast on Monday. The British Foreign Secretary David Cameron, a former prime minister, is in Washington today, in part to lobby for the U.S. House to pass a bill with aid for Ukraine. The Senate has already done so, and President Biden said he'll sign it into law if it passes the House. Secretary Cameron held a joint news conference at the State Department with Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
Foreign Secretary Cameron, you said before coming to the U.S. that you would encourage Speaker Johnson to get Ukraine aid through the House, but now you are not seeing him. Why is that? And have you left your meeting with President Trump believing that he will give Johnson the green light to make that vote happen?
Thank you. I'm going to be going to the Hill. I've got a range of meetings with senators and congressmen both sides of the aisle. I always do this with great trepidation. It's not for foreign politicians to tell legislators in another country what to do. It's just that I'm so passionate about the importance of defending Ukraine against this aggression, that I think it is absolutely the interests of U.S. security that Putin fails in his illegal invasion. I think it's good for U.S. jobs that we continue to back Ukraine with the weapons that they need. And I think in terms of how the United States and the United Kingdom as allies are seen around the world, there will be people in Tehran, in Pyongyang, in Beijing, looking at how we stand by our allies, how we help them, how we stop this illegal and unprovoked aggression, and working out whether we are committed, whether we're prepared to see it through. So I'm here to offer my opinion, to meet with anyone who wants to talk to me about it, to make those arguments. And I think the perspective, I always encourage others in Europe, particularly perhaps those right up against the fence with Russia, who feel the Russian aggression, who feel the fear of it. And I think, as I said at the NATO summit last week, it's so important that the outcome of all this is a secure and strong NATO with full US and Atlantic support, rather than a setback for the Western alliance, a victory for Putin, and a sense that we don't stand by our allies and our friends at their time of need. So that's the spirit in which I'm here. I'm delighted to have a whole series of meetings this afternoon and some more tomorrow, and I'll make time for any people in Congress who would welcome a conversation about this.
British Foreign Secretary David Cameron at the State Department in Washington, a joint news conference with Secretary of State Antony Blinken. You heard a reference that on Monday he was at Mar-a-Lago in Florida meeting with former president and Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump. Fox News says that the British government's foreign office described it as standard practice to meet with an opposition candidate, with Trump being the presumptive Republican nominee for this year's presidential election. From Reuters, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida said on Tuesday he sees opportunities for more collaboration between Japan and the United States in next-generation computer chips. Kishida made the remarks at a business roundtable on critical and emerging technologies hosted by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in Washington the day before the Japanese leader is to hold a summit with U.S. President Joe Biden. Earlier on Tuesday, U.S. firm Microsoft said it would invest $2.9 billion over 2 years to expand its cloud and AI infrastructure in Japan, its largest investment in the 46 years of its operations in the country. That was from Reuters. Here are the remarks by the Japanese Prime Minister.
Last year, Japanese FDI to the United States surpassed $750 billion, making Japan the largest investor to the United States for four consecutive years since 2019. Japanese businesses operate in more than 8,500 locations around the United States, creating close to 1 million jobs. The theme for today's roundtable is cooperation in critical and emerging technology. In such areas as innovation, clean energy economy and supply chains, and on such technologies as semiconductors, AI, quantum computing, and biotech, it is increasingly important for our two countries to build resilience in our economies and together drive growth for the global economy. In the semiconductor field, Rapidus is partnering with a U.S. company in research and development of next-generation chips, and there will surely be more such opportunities for collaboration between Japan and the United States. On generative AI, we are most appreciative to the U.S. companies that have generously provided computational resources to AI development initiatives supported by the government of Japan. Further, under the Hiroshima AI process, Japan and the U.S. are cooperating in international rules-making and in attracting support for more countries and businesses. In energy and GX, Through the synergy between Japan's GX promotion strategy and the Inflation Reduction Act of the United States, we shall seek to accelerate green transformation, pursue diverse pathways responding to specific situations in each country, and together contribute to global decarbonization. In addition, through collaboration between businesses and research institutes of our two countries that possess diverse advanced technologies, I am hopeful that we can lead the world towards green transformation. At the same time, Japan welcomes investments from the United States that push forward such cooperation in critical and emerging technology.
The Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, through an interpreter today at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce program in Washington at the start of his official visit to the United States. He also laid a wreath at Arlington National Cemetery. He will stop by the White House Tuesday night ahead of Wednesday's official visit with the president, which will include a joint news conference and also a state dinner. Today, the First Lady Jill Biden at the White House previewed that dinner.
So, good evening and welcome to our state dinner preview. Isn't it beautiful? So tomorrow we find the common threads of humanity that connect us, that transcend distance or difference, built on shared values as we celebrate the flourishing friendship between the United States and Japan. And those threads that bind us, people to people, heart to heart. As technology dissolves the distances between us and we face challenges that cross borders and oceans, our nations are partners in building a world where we choose creation over destruction, peace over bloodshed, and democracy over autocracy. President Biden and I are honored to welcome Prime Minister and Mrs. Kishida to the United States for an official visit with a state dinner tomorrow night. And we look forward to returning the hospitality and friendship that we have experienced in our travels to Japan. For dinner, the state floor will transform into a vibrant spring garden, a place of joy and renewal, of hope and growth. As guests sit among the field of flowers, glass and silk butterflies from both our countries will dance over the tables.
First Lady Jill Biden at the White House, along with the Social Secretary and the chefs, previewing the state dinner for the Japanese Prime Minister, which will happen on Wednesday night. And Associated Press reporting that Paul Simon, one of Jill Biden's favorite musicians, will be entertaining at that state dinner. Fumio Kishida will be the fifth world leader to have a state dinner during the Joe Biden presidency. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's free evening newsletter, Word for Word, and you'll get the stories making headlines in Washington sent to your inbox every day. Sign up at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night.